A written transcript of this episode is provided by Starburst. For more information, you can see the show notes.
Welcome to Data Mesh Radio with your host, Scott Herleman, sponsored by Starburst. Starburst is a single platform to help you activate all your data, no matter where it lives. Check out our new Data Products for Dummies ebook to learn more about how your organization can utilize data products. To download your free copy, head on over to starburst.io.
Data Mesh Radio is provided as a free community resource by Data Mesh Understanding. It is produced and hosted by me, Scott Herleman. I started this podcast as a place for practitioners to get useful information about Data Mesh, and we're at over 200 episodes. I've now left DataStax, thanks for all their help in founding things, but I've left to start Data Mesh Understanding, which is also helping practitioners to get to the information needed to do Data Mesh well. We have free implementer introduction and roundtable programs, in addition to the more advanced yet affordable offerings. So please do get in touch if you're looking for more information on how to approach Data Mesh. Just check datameshunderstanding.com for more info. There's also a helpful organization of past Data Mesh Radio episodes there if you want to dig into specific topics rather than digging through 200 different episodes. So with that, let's hit the funky intro music and listen to what you'll hear about in this interview episode. Learnings from 25 plus years in data quality. Bottom line up front, what are you going to hear about and learn about in this episode? Interviewed Olga Medenchik, who's an information management practitioner, educator, and evangelist. And we were obviously talking about data quality. So here are some key takeaways or thoughts from Olga's point of view. Number one, learn your data quality history. There are people who have been fighting this good fight of data quality for 25 plus years. Even for over a century, if you look at statistical quality control, don't needlessly reinvent some of the stuff that's already been created. Number two, data literacy is a very important aspect of data quality. If people don't understand the costs of bad quality, they're far less likely to care about quality in general. Number three, data quality can be a tricky topic. If you let consumers know that the data quality isn't perfect, they can lose trust. But A, in general, that conversation is getting better and easier to have. And B, we have to be able to identify quality as a problem in order to actually fix it. We need people to be part of the actual solution to fixing it. Number four, data quality is not a project. It's a continuous process. Number five, even now, people are finding it hard to use well-established data quality dimensions. It's a framework for considering, measuring, understanding data quality. So it's not very helpful to data stewards or data engineers in creating data quality rules. It's, it helps you understand it, but it's not a direct one-to-one for actually creating the rules. Number six, the majority of quality errors are not random. They come from faulty data mapping or bugs in the pipeline. Having good quality rules will catch a large percentage of errors that can be fixed in bulk. Number seven, when thinking about getting started around data quality, it doesn't have to be complex and with lots of tools. We have people looking at the data for potential issues and talking to producers. Then you can build a business case for fixing the data to get the funding. You have to roll up your sleeves and talk to people, but you can get forward momentum without a huge amount of budget. Number eight, data quality issues aren't inherently material to the business processes. They're only bad when they cause issues for the business. You have to find those actual business issues to get people to care and get funding for fixing those data quality issues. Quality for the sake of quality is just extra cost. Do not create too many DQ rules that do not matter. Number nine, relatedly, being able to show someone a relatively basic quality indicator early is far better than asking for a lot of budget to figure out quality levels. You can do that with something as simple as random sampling 1 to 200 records and an hour of 1 to 2 people's time that actually know the data. You can just go through it manually and say, here's a rough estimate of what our quality is at. Number 10, to understand which data quality challenges and use cases are the most important, data people simply have to learn more about the business. Good data quality is about fit for purpose, and that means understanding the purposes. Number 11, to find your initial good data quality use cases, look to mission criticality. What dashboards or reports are actually important to the company and why? Then work backwards to see if quality is an issue for those dashboards and reports. That's how you find your early buy-in to work on a quality initiative that can scale. Number 12, I think this one is controversial. Data contracts are not at all new. We just now have a good enough set of tools and technologies to be able to do them better at scale. You know, I think that's an interesting view that she's got there. Number 13, potentially controversial. Most are doing data contracts, not that well. For them, it's about the technology and not the process. There isn't a continuous approach to the way many people are doing data contracts. Personal note here, Andrew Jones has said the same thing. It's about ensuring a process that results in quality data. It's not all about the tools. The tools are helpful to helping you kind of establish and measure and do a lot of things, but it's not only about the tools. Number 14, for data contracts, there must be a feedback loop, or we aren't actually delivering to needs, especially as needs evolve. Look to the widely used consumer supply model for insights into what we need to achieve and how when it comes to data contracts. Number 15, many companies are creating actual financial incentives tied to data quality in order to ensure people care about data quality. That's not right for every organization, but it does send a clear message as to the importance of data quality. Number 16, you have to consider your data supply chain. If your interface for data input is bad, your data is very likely to be bad. It's to be a bad quality. People will simply enter garbage just to move forward if you have a bad UX. Number 17, doing data quality manually is not sustainable or scalable. But you don't need to start with expensive tools. You can get your arms around things initially pretty easily. It will help you identify your actual problems instead of spending time specifically on tools. Finally, number 18, and potentially controversial one here. Many vendors are selling their tools as the fix to data quality, but detecting data errors with the tools is only the start of the data quality improvements. Once errors are detected, root cause analysis for the errors needs to be performed and the processes and code needs to be fixed. None of the data quality tools can do this. It's a human job. Beware the snake oil in the data quality space.
Okay, enough of just me. Let's hear from our awesome guest in this interview episode. Okay, very, very excited for today's episode. I've got Olga Majdanchuk here, who is an information management practitioner, educator, and evangelist. And she's been working in the data quality space for, over 2 decades now. And so we're going to be talking a lot about data quality and how we can learn from things that have already been done in this space from a practices and approaches standpoint and start to embrace the new tooling that we're starting to see kind of come out. We've seen this renaissance around tooling and a big focus and even an ability for us to talk about data quality being a challenge, which historically wasn't something that really we could talk about. But we're also now treating it as if the tooling is the thing that's going to solve it instead of the approaches plus the tooling, and or that we're trying to completely invent new ways and approaches when this stuff is already been out there. So we're going to talk a lot about a bunch of different aspects around that topic, because I think this is something that I keep seeing with data mesh of people trying to reinvent the way we approach data whole cloth instead of taking things that work either from software or that have been developed in data or that from outside of, in the physical sciences and, supply chain management and all this stuff, manufacturing. We don't have to reinvent everything whole cloth. We can just kind of take what works, see what we're trying to do, and bring that to data. But before we get to that, Olga, if you don't mind, if you could give people a bit of background on yourself, and then we can jump into the conversation at hand.
Hi, my name is Olga, and I'm a practitioner, an educator. I want to address the part of a practitioner. I worked in many large enterprises such as AIG and Citi and Deutsche Bank and Voya Financial, and I worked as a part of the chief data offices, and we were trying to implement excellent data management practices. So I know everything, the good, the bad, and the ugly about those implementation. That's what I mean by practitioner. I'm also an educator. Ever since 2006 or something, I am creating various educational programs and classes on different topics of information management. For example, I started with creating the Data Quality for Practitioners program that is like 5 full days treatment of all data quality topics. Now, I used to go to the conferences, but now everything is available online. So majority of my work is on a company called The Learning Curve that provides online education and certification. I'm also a very active member of Enterprise Data Management Council, and I participated in the design of something called DKM, which stands for Data Management Capability Assessment Model, which is a guide to implement data management practices within the organizations. So it literally describes the capability that you need to build in order to create the effective data management functions. That's about me.
Awesome. Well, and I'm excited to talk about, because when we were talking in the pre-call, you were saying you started down this road around data quality in the late 90s, right? Like
somewhere around 97, yes.
Yeah. This stuff has been around for a long time. We've known that data quality is a challenge, and yet we weren't really able to talk that well about it. So like, why can you give us a little bit of that history as to what was happening in that space and kind of why it maybe didn't catch on as well then, and while we have a little bit of an opportunity for it to catch on much more now, but that we can learn from what people have already done. We don't have to reinvent this. So I'd love to hear a little bit about that, and we can kind of sprinkle in the questions as we're going through.
Yeah. So I actually started in the late 90s. And I worked for a fairly small company called Archidata Corporation, and this company was performing data cleansing for human resource data. So think about it, if you work for the company like Citi or Deutsche Bank or any other one, they don't manage the 401k plan administration or pension plan administration. They are giving this data to some kind of pension providers such as, Fidelities and Voya and you name it. So in a sense, they are putting the data from one place to another. Now, those providers like Fidelity and stuff, right? They're saying, hey, if we manage it and if there are mistakes and we'll calculate something incorrectly, that's on you. It's not on us. We are going to charge your arm and a leg for every mistake. That's why it was a really necessity for the companies to clean up the data prior to what they, what they give it to providers. So first of all, that was normal, right? What wasn't normal, that they used to operate in a blind, and I'm talking about things available on the internet. So if you think about the 80s, you would get your quarterly statement or maybe yearly statements. That's how much you would know. So what happened in the late 90s, they started creating online portals for employees where all of a sudden the data became available on a daily basis. So any employee who, let's say, have this kind of 401k pension plan or any health benefits or welfare benefits, they could just go online and see, okay, what's my balance as of today? etc. So if there are any mistakes, the person would happen, two things would happen. First, if person found mistake in not in his favor, then he would call and you would spend money on a customer service call. So your company is losing. Now, if the mistake was in the favor of a person, guess what? Person would not call. So the company is going to lose anyway. So data quality was really, really important, but company didn't want to admit it. So literally we were having trouble of any company wanted to be on the records that they were our clients. So I personally cleaned up the data for 15 hugest companies, and I cannot say who they were. So.
Well, and I'd love to have a little bit of that conversation of historically, it sounded like what you were saying was you were cleaning up that data. Probably a lot of it was manual cleaning and things like that. Or
oh, no.
Were we actually having tools that worked back then for that?
No, we actually ended up creating our own tool that was doing the data quality assessment. That was the automated rules. Now, mind you, that was before data quality dimensions were invented. So I actually posted my rule charts, the all different data quality rules that could possibly be created. This post generated probably 700 likes within the 3 days or something, because people were amazed, because people are still trying to figure out how to do that, how to use the data quality dimensions. And they are great for maybe reporting and everything, but they don't do any directions to the developer who is tasked with creating the data quality rules. So first of all, we did the automatic rules, and then we did automatic corrections. That was actually, even up to now, I still don't see the tool that are doing corrections. And if think about it, it's like a little program that corrects the errors. The reason you could do it, that majority of data quality errors are not random. They are created by either some kind of problems in the integrations, or sometimes the feed got cut off, right? That's mean it's not just one problem here and there. It's just that's mean it's affect a lot of subjects. You know, what's the data is about. That's why you could do those automatic corrections to do so. Yeah, it was pretty high tech thing. Yeah,
that's interesting that it feels like when I look at kind of data observability and quality tooling and stuff, it does feel like it's so far behind software. And part of it is that automated remediation, because it's like, if this stuff isn't rocket science 80% of the time, it's like, hey, we think it's this. If it's this, then click yes, and it just automates the remediation instead of manually going in and do it. But, it's all it's something that is getting more complex with the more volume and things that we're doing. But so part of what you were doing was the tooling that could help and somewhat detect and things like that. We're seeing much better tooling now, but the processes around this, right? Of actually working with people to understand A, data quality necessary levels, and B, how do we evolve what we're actually working together with people, that feedback loop that I when we were talking, you said the data contracts, so many people are talking as if it's a one and done, and that's not around a data product. A product has a continual conversation with its users, right? That's what product management is about. It's about that feedback loop. So how would you think about talking to someone about what, if they're struggling with data quality right now and they don't know where to start, how do you get them kind of headed in the right direction? Is it find a couple of use cases and focus there? Is it kind of a more broad thing? And how do you broach that subject of there's people aspects to data too. It's not just the ones and the zeros. How do you have that conversation since you're such an educator?
So first of all, use cases are great, because once, and you also want to kind of to have some kind of an activity. I call it data gazing. Some people do the stargazing. Sometimes I do the data gazing. So actually, the data can't tell you the story. You just have to listen. So in a sense, if you look at the data, you will find some kind of problems that kind of like seems odd to you. And then this is just your assumption that something could go wrong, right? And then you could go to your business user and say, hey, is it indeed wrong? And they say, oh my God, it is wrong. It needs to be fixed. So if we are talking about just how to start, I mean, you do need funding, first of all. So basically, you try to kind of like go for the bigger pieces that kind of could relate to the, how to say, to basically to the bottom line. And often those projects are done on a side because in order to get good funding, you have to show how bad your data are. Because you can't just go and say, hey, give me like, you know, $500,000 and then I'll tell you how bad your data are. That's why you kind of like try to shoestring and try to create some kind of like scores for the data quality and then show it to, you know, your CFO, your other C-level executive and say, hey, this is what we could do. So for example, that's exactly what we did at AIG. We created something called data quality index that affected the portfolios of managed properties. So basically, like, think about that there is a hurricane, right? And it destroys the building. AIG is a big insurance company. So, and some building characteristics affect how good the building will withstand, you know, this hurricane and any other catastrophes. And in a sense, if data are missing, then the regulation require you to assume the worst case scenario. Now, let me tell you, for example, building could be made out of brick, out of stone, out of, you know, wood, whatever it is, right? And wood is the, you know, the weakest building. So if you have a field missing, you have to assume that it is made of wood, the best, right? But what's important based on the smart people called actuary, based on all kind of data, calculate how much money you have to put aside so that the insurer would have enough money to pay during the unfortunate event. And the more money you put aside, the worse it's for a company because you can't touch this money. You can't put them for work. You can't, you know, continue to accrue the interest. You just have to have them in a pile. So you kind of have to have enough, but not more than that. And actually, data quality have direct correlation to how much money you put aside. Now, this amount of money you have to put aside goes to the quarterly financial statements. So in a sense, we did this assessment. We showed how much it's influenced data quality, like in some cases, 10 to 15%. We went to CFO and CFO gave us money for real. So, but in a sense, we did do some kind of like a shoestring situation where we did the assessment, we found the problems, and then we asked for money. So this is actually works better than trying to say, hey, give me things, and maybe a year later, I'll tell you, well, once I implement all my tools, then I'll give you the story.
Do you have, I mean, it's a great example of how much this can impact a company. Do you have any kind of advice for somebody on going and finding that use case, right? Going and finding, okay, I should actually, I should have that or like have the conversation with somebody where you can both admit that there's a data quality problem and that it's not the end of the world and that we're going to get more funding to fix it. Because I mean, it is one of those things where data people historically haven't wanted to open up that can of worms because it's led to much worse outcomes of, well, now I can't trust it at all because there's data quality issues. And like, do you have a way of finding those? Is it just the people that are screaming the loudest? Is it the people that are screaming the loudest that also are empathetic? Or like, how do you think about getting the ball rolling? Because quality for me is about momentum, right? It's not as if you spread quality across all your data across the entire organization at once, because that's just way too much effort and way too much wasted momentum as you're getting going.
Mm-hmm. My advice is to learn the business. So unfortunately, often the data quality is done by a group within either IT or chief data office, and it's done by people who have an IT background. And often those people are not the people who worked in the company for 20 or 30 years. They probably freshly hired and everything, so they don't know the business. You cannot really have data quality management without understanding what you do, because data quality is fitness for use, right? By definition. So to me, a couple of ways. So first of all, talk to the people about the process, right? What they do, et cetera. Ask them what kind of reports they rely on. So the problem is right now that the IT generates zillions reports. We have so many dashboards that no one uses, et cetera. But out of these thousands of dashboards that exist, maybe two or three are actually the ones that are used for reporting, the ones that are used for something. So you have to find those dashboards and basically go from that. What this or whatever the report, what's this cell on this report? Where does it come from? And then you kind of do the little bit of a lineage exercise backwards that bring you back to your, you know, sources of your data, et cetera. It's easy in financial companies because in financial companies, there are a very standard set of reporting that's required by Federal Reserve. So literally, your work's cut out for you. Everything that's on this report, that's what's important. In different industries, it's different, right? But marketing, again, marketing campaign, use what kind of data they are using for marketing, right? Sales, look what they're using for sales, et cetera. So, but again, you have to talk to people. You have to look at what they're
using. Yeah. And that's advice that a lot of data people don't like, is you have to talk to the business people.
Unfortunately.
Well, and you have to kind of treat it like within data, people think that, oh, I have had one conversation, therefore this person is convinced and I can move forward, versus continuous. It's the same thing of learning on the business. It's not as if you go in and you spend, you know, 10 minutes or you know, a 30-minute conversation or an hour-long conversation and you have learned the business, versus like, hey, like, let's figure out how we collaborate together and let's make sure that I get what drives your business and how does business drive your, or how does data drive your business and how could data drive your business if we brought it to the right levels? But like, let's be realistic. So when I say, you know, when do you need it real time and what quality level 100%, that you don't say those things, or I tell you that, you know, no, go back to the drawing board and have real conversations. It's very difficult. So I'd love to hear what we were talking about in the pre-call of how people have dealt with data quality historically, that it seems like people are kind of ignoring a bit now, right? And I've had this conversation a little bit with Andrew Jones as well about about data contracts and how we think about conversations, because so many people are trying to make it as if I post some data and post it with my contract and that is good enough, instead of collaboratively approach these conversations. So I know what you need, why you need it, and I structure it in such a way that other people could use it. That's the data product approach, but that I actually understand what you need, instead of I just provide you some data and assume you're using it correctly and that you get it and that it's what you want, and that we don't have this hidden total cost of ownership where all of a sudden all the consumers are all doing the same transformations and the same, you know, have the same cleaning issues and the same everything like that. So I'd love to hear how you were looking at, you know, these consumer supplier models and data contracts and how that works together.
So first of all, what I before even I go to all these models and the previous work done by great people, I just want to say that data quality is not a project. It's a process. It's a continuous improvement process. So there is a cycle always, right? And there is no beginning and no the end, right? It's kind of like going in circles and circles and circles. So in a sense, one of the things that I've noticed in data contracts, because they are very technology driven, there is no this cycle, there is no feedback loop, etc. So I already mentioned that there are like several great people working since the beginning of a century on different models how to do the process improvement, and which everything could be applicable to data quality. And I'm going to name some of the people who influenced, you know, my work in general. So we'll start with a person named Walter Schuchart. So he worked for the Bell Laboratories, and he invented something called the Statistical Process Control, or SPC. And it, so once he pioneered it, I believe like in the 1924. But the people, when they are talking right now, for example, about data observability, sometimes many of them don't know that data observability is based on this statistical process control invented by the beginning of a century. Now, there was another very famous person, his name, William Edwards Deming, and he was actually, he worked also like from 1900s to, you know, maybe like mid-60s or something. And he was known as a father of the quality improvements. So he actually worked in a post-war Japan, and he's credited with literally revolutionizing Japan industry, especially the car manufacturing. So, and the Japanese are still one of the most like the big powers, you know, in the world about the car producers. So he took the Schuchart work, and then he developed it further. In a sense, this is like amazing. Now, going back to data quality, there was a person named Larry P. English. He died probably, I don't know, like five, six, maybe like a decade ago. But he was the father of data quality. Truly, he did so much for the disciplines, you can't even name it. And he developed something called the total quality management. So there were a lot of approaches. I also want to mention someone who is very much alive and still contribute a lot to the field. One of my favorite people is Tom Redmond. He's also called the Data Doc. And he also took a lot of things that were developed for the process improvement, and he applied those things for the data quality management. Now, all of them have a feedback loop. So, for example, I want to talk about the customer supply model, which is accepted like pretty much everywhere. So you have a customer and you have a supplier. Now, as a customer, you tell supplier what you want. So you provide kind of like a requirements. And then supplier gives you whatever he thinks you want. However, customer never satisfied. So customer have to give a feedback and say, hey, you give me something, but can you change this? Can you change that? So requirements are changing, and supply has to adjust. Now, requirements could change or something else could change, but this is basically a whole loop. Now, when I am a customer of someone, I am also a supplier to somebody else. And that somebody else, he is a customer of someone and supplier to somebody else. So you are thinking about overextending this customer supplier model in both directions. So it basically illustrates the data on the move. So the data do the hop from one customer to supplier to the other to the other. So if you're talking about data contracts, right, they are pretty much exist between each customer and supplier, right? So we need to do that. Now, we could monitor data quality and everything, but there are errors, right? There will be errors. We are not living in a perfect world. So we have to somehow to find a way to resolve those errors, right? And that's basically the feedback. And when you resolve it, you have to go to customer and say, ask, do you see this error? Did we really fix it for real? Or did we just like put the band-aid or something like that? Yeah. So this is one of the best models I know in the industry. Even if you don't have a data quality tool, if you don't have money for that, use this model and create your data quality, beginning of your data quality practice based on this model. That's what you should do.
So I have a couple of things there. One, Ale Cabrera was kind of talking about this when she on her episode, because you know, she was managing a data product that was literally for external consumers, like they were consuming this data. And that was what they were purchasing from the company. And so she was talking a lot about that of proactive communication as well of, hey, we saw this error, we fixed it. Like, we wanted to make sure that you know that we found the error. And if you did run across this error, you know, we fixed it and addressing that. But I have a little bit potentially of pushback or a bit of how do we actually do this question for you? Because what you were talking about was kind of almost the business lineage of data, right? Where you go like, okay, there's not just one simple consumer of your information. That consumer has consumers. They are a supplier and therefore they have consumers off of them. When you think about gathering, and I don't even know that we want to call it requirements anymore because requirements has kind of almost a bad connotation, but let's call it requirements. You're gathering what your customer, your immediate consumer needs. Do you have to keep going all the way downstream and say what those other people need? Or do they, is it, I kind of ask about this of, is all this work on the data supplier, the data producer, or what do we owe each other? What does that consumer owe their supplier when it comes to feedback in that conversation? And how, as a producer, do you get that consumer to just tell you what they actually need? Because what I've found historically are a lot of issues. One, that we just have a bunch of silent consumers. They find data and they use it instead of actually creating the relationship. And two, if you ask anybody, would you like this data? They say yes, versus like, what, because they just want more data, right? More data could be more useful rather than what's the right data? What data do you actually need? So like as a data producer, we're saying, okay, you need to have these conversations. Is it merely you have to be open to these conversations or do you have to go seek them out? Do you have to do kind of product discovery and figure out what data product should I create? Do you have to go and do like NPS measurement and, you know, and all this stuff? Or is it on the producers? Like, what would you recommend to an organization to make this actually function? And maybe, you know, we can talk about at the start and, you know, because it's not going to be very productive and great at the start versus where it heads. But like, how do you think about having that conversation of who owns what in this relationship? A relationship is two sides or multiple sides, but, you know.
Well, as a producer, frankly, unless you have a customer, there is no reason for you to produce, right? Why would, for example, you produce a bunch of shoes if no one needs your shoes? So you don't produce something that no one needs, right? Now, when you, let's say, selling your shoes, people are giving you feedback, you know, oh yeah, you know, this is no arch support, there is no this, there is no that, etc. So your job as a producer to take the feedback and create the next version of your product per se, right? Based on the feedback to whatever you got. So as a customer, if you are silent, you know, and you are not saying what you need, then producers are not mind readers. You're going to get what you're going to get, but it doesn't mean that it's going to, you know, satisfy you. So to me, if you are not open in terms of how you want to do it and actively actually participate in everything, you're not going to get anything. Absolutely. So that's the roles. Yeah.
So I guess my question is a little bit of how do we convince producers that they have to engage in these conversations? And how do we let suppliers know that requirement drops are no longer sufficient? You just saying, here are my requirements, serve me this data. It doesn't work because the world has changed. People don't understand the requirements right from the start. Like, we need to have active back and forth conversations. What have you seen that works for actually facilitating that?
So it is very difficult because actually data produced by people at the beginning in the big enterprises, and those people couldn't care less about how other people will be using it. So let me give you an example. Let's say in the mortgage industry, right? There is a person who wants to close the mortgage. And he just want to have a signature on a dotted line. So he doesn't care whether he have information about his customer correctly and some other things, because he is not using this data, right? Or any other salesperson. Salesperson wants to close the deal and he doesn't care how good a lot of data elements are, right? Or we are talking about sometimes the customer service reps, again, they are just doing the job, right? But they don't even know where the data are using. So this is where my other favorite things in the data management, it's called data literacy. You absolutely have to educate every single person in the company, especially the ones on the front lines, the ones who are data creators. Educate them how important it is for them to do that. Now, you as a company, you also have to put the correct incentives, right? If your incentives are to make them more deals, right, then and no one cares about quality, then that's what you're going to get. So some of the companies actually creating bonus structures for employees who are producing the data that are better than the average quality. So again, it's financial, frankly, thing, but without this kind of encouragement, without literacy education, without explaining people that everything that they are doing is super important for other things, right? Then it's basically, and it's going to get back to them in a way of bonuses, in a way of how much money the company is going to make and how much money is not going to lose because of you didn't do this field correctly or that field correctly. So you just have to educate people.
Yeah, I think Irina Arzner from RBI was talking a little bit about this, that I think it's interesting. Her incentive for participating in data mesh and sharing her team's data with the rest of the organization is she wants to prove out how much value her data has to other parts of the organization so she gets more investment back. Now, there are very few that are that forward leaning, so it is somewhat on the data team and it is somewhat on working with the kind of transformation offices and things like that to teach people why this is important. And so that education, but that incentivization, for most teams, they're not going to be as kind of forward thinking as Irina is of, if I can prove out that my data has a bunch of value, I'm going to get a bunch more investment in my team's data work. And guess who gets the most value out of my team's data work? It's my team. It's not these other ones. These other ones do get good value, but I get the most out of it. So I'm going to get that, which means I can drive better business and that I can drive more money for my team. But that simple thing of incentivization of why should you do this and how do I prove to you that this is a value? Yeah, I have this with the data mesh where people are like, we want data producers to produce all this data. And it's like, okay, but how are you incentivizing them? And it's like, well, we're telling them they have to do this. And it's like, oh, great. So what did you take off their plate so that they could do this? And they're like, well, nothing. It's like, okay, so did you give them extra people, you know, more, you know, I hate to call people resources, but more resources to be able to do this? And they're like, no. And it's like, then of course they're going to fight. You just gave them a lot more work without any real positive benefit. And there's a lot of negative benefit because there's still a bunch of things that they don't get paid on that you're now asking them to do. And, you know, not everybody's coin operated, pay driven, but at the same point, everybody is to some degree. And so like exactly how you're talking about this has to, you talked about this earlier, you have to tie this to the financial incentives of the company, the financial, like, what are you trying to do as a company? What does data quality tie into that? Okay, can we get funding to improve this aspect of this thing of quality? Okay, hey, we had a big success here. Okay, we find the next two or three use cases. Hey, we had a big success here. Now you've got this kind of momentum. I did a mesh musings on this a while back of maintaining mesh momentum versus measuring mesh value, and like trying to maximize the amount of value that you've created is actually a bit of a fool's errand versus that momentum of, do you have to keep going back every single time and starting from scratch to get people bought in that this matters versus educating everybody? So like, I think this is such an important conversation. I'd love to hear if you've got anything about like how people can, again, start these conversations, like you know, you said go and find the people, go and talk to them. But like, how do you have fruitful conversations with people? Because I keep having data people come back to me and go, I don't know how to talk to these business people. So anything that you can help there would be great.
Well, in a sense, first of all, when I believe if you work in a company and you don't know the business, that's on you. I mean, there is nothing I could do. Go and try to find out what's the company you're working for, what it does, how it makes money. And then, in a sense, you know, just start asking people and try to, you know, learn as much as it's possible. As I said, there are lots of, you know, lunch and learn series and everything. People are usually, you know, like to talk about what they do, right? They like to share. People honestly have very good intentions. The other thing what you could examine is, like we talked about, giving incentives to people to enter correct data. But the other thing what we could examine user interfaces that those people are using, right? Because if the user interface is inconvenient, and it's a lot of data to add, you are going to get garbage because, you know, you're going to get the first available, you know, value in your drop-down list that's going to be the value, or you're going to be an A or something like that. Or that's why, you know, Mickey Mouse is one of the most often occurring name in any marketing database, like literally, because just people are sick and tired of entering the information where marketing people wants to have it. It's kind of like it doesn't have anything to do with the product, but you have to fill it in. And people are just, they don't want to share this information. So they are specifically entering incorrect data just because they have to enter something, right? But they don't want to do it. And I'm not really sure what's the value in collecting all this incorrect data. So some of the mistakes could be corrected by improving UI and asking for much less from people that what would be left, you know, what would you want to know? So, yeah. But in a sense, there is nothing you can do. You have to talk. You have to find who are producing data, and that's your conversation.
And I think you pushed on something a little bit that we could talk about a little more of, pushing back and saying you don't need that data, right? Like I used to do sales operations and some marketing operations and stuff for a startup, and the number of leads that came in that were from Alabama in the U.S. specifically was incredibly high. Because it's the first drop down. So if you require somebody's state, people chose Alabama all the time. And so, you know, it was very difficult dealing with patch assignment and stuff like that, because the number of leads going to Alabama was 100% incorrect. And so we had to do that, you know. And so, I think, again, I've poked at this a few times and I keep coming back to it, but like, how do you have a fruitful conversation with people who are used to just saying, this is what I want, and then somebody comes back to them with something, and it's not really what they want, and it's definitely not what they need, but it's something, versus like, hey, we have to partner together. No, you can't have, right? Have you found that they push back on that, or that they're okay with that? Because a lot of people are saying, people are pretty reasonable, but I also talk to people and they go, I hate having that conversation because people are used to just saying, get me the data, and I go and get them the data.
Yes. So what I found sometimes as the customer of the data, you are expecting, it's kind of like an electricity. You're expecting the lights in a house and you're expecting kind of like everything to be light. But all of a sudden when the electricity is cut off and it's dark, you kind of like don't want to do anything because you are thinking that it's a, you know, it's a IT problem, right? Or it's a data people supposed to do it. But also when you ask customers for some kind of help, you know, trying to, you know, help them out to try to do that, they actually don't want to do it because, again, they want to have electricity, but they don't want to pay for the bill for the electricity. So that's a conversation you actually have to have with them at the beginning, because to me, there is no point of even having the data quality initiative started if you don't have an agreement that two people will be, you know, two parties will be working on it together. Because once you produce the list of everything that is wrong, somebody got to look at this. Somebody got to fix it. And somebody has to prioritize it. And somebody has to say, oh, this is actually not an arrow. You know, that's just, we don't care about that. But this is an important, right? So it is very intimate knowledge of data, very intimate knowledge of business. And I mean, yes, you do need to learn to business, but probably not to the point of, you know, like where you could just look at this and say, no, that's wrong, based on your experience. So if you don't have a partner in that, don't start this initiative. That's basically, you have to have a commitment, right? That's your first step before buying tools and everything. Have a commitment, have weekly conversations, and basically say, hey, you know, by the way, the Tom Randman, the person who I mentioned as the data doc, he has something called the methods of, I don't remember what the name was, but something about Friday. So you literally print out the 100 records between two people from producers and consumer, print out 100 records and go one by one and check how many of them are correctly and how many of them are incorrectly and come up with this some kind of a rough percentage. Manual exercise, you don't need a tool, right? You do need an expertise and a data, but that's a conversation that could start, okay, out of all the errors that we identify, what's important? What's the first priority, second priority, third priority, et cetera? And then that's what you do. And of course, you go to how can we fix it? Again, fixing is completely separate.
Yeah, but yeah, it's identifying what matters and why and having an actual fruitful conversation. So I think we've covered a lot on the kind of producer, consumer side. There was one place that I kind of wanted to head into as we're wrapping up the conversation, which was right now going back to what we were talking about of there's this kind of huge boom in data quality related tooling. And yet people want to use the latest and greatest, but we don't necessarily need to use the latest and greatest. So how do we balance that desire of people wanting to kind of overcomplicate things, but as well balance that so that we aren't just saying, oh, just do manual data checking, because people aren't going to want to do that. And so you can't attract and retain talent because they don't want to do that. So like, how do you think about having that conversation internally as at a company as to how far is too far, how far is not far enough, as to what should we do on the kind of going for the latest and the greatest versus, you know, and spending a whole bunch of money to buy all these tools and invest in all this infrastructure and all these people and all of this versus kind of the value. But at the same point, just saying, well, we could do all this manually in spreadsheets or anything like that. You're going to say, well, we could, but that's terrible for my career. So I'm going to leave.
Well, I guess I am actually the person who likes to play with the latest tools and toys. So I might be not the best one to give advice. But first of all, doing everything manually is non-sustainable. At the same time, I truly believe that every data quality initiative should start with literally running some SQLs and finding the problems, right? So you could create, to be quite honest, in my last place of employment, we didn't have originally the money for the tool. So we created our own rule engine in Oracle based on, you know, some kind of smart model. We created the model inside the Oracle and created a bunch of store procedures. It took us probably, I don't know, like one person, 2 or 3 weeks. So it wasn't much of the investment. And we were capable of assessing data quality in the databases with like 50 million records. So it wasn't like too shabby. Now, it was just for Oracle. We couldn't assess any other data stores, etc. But you have to start somewhere, right? So create something, run some SQL, show them. Now, after you find errors, again, the most important thing is to figure out the process. What are you going to do with your errors? Who are you going to go to? Number one, who's going to tell you that that's an error, truly error, that needs to be fixing versus that that's okay, you know, because not all errors are actually bad. So And then you have to figure out how do you resolve, who do you talk to, how far back do you want to go? Because as we said, the data are jumping. Do you just want to go two hops or do you want to go all the way? And the longer you go, the more expensive this fix is, right? But nevertheless, again, there got to be a process. So once you set up your process, once you found this, then you can ask for money. And then, you know, go get the best tool on the market. And probably if the process is there, that there is no reason for the company not to give you funds for that.
Yeah. I think that's a great way to kind of wrap up how we're thinking about this. Cause I think it is so much of this is get started. It's so much have the conversations with people, and you are going to have to buy things in this space. Just trying to do it all manually, as you said, not scalable, but And you can have those conversations with people of, hey, yes, we're going to get to those amazing, fun things to play with, but we kind of have to scope the problem and the issue first before we head down.
I actually want to add something, you know, something occurred to me. So what happened, we talked about data literacy, we talked about education in general for people. You know, people need to know that, hey, there are things exist, there are data governance exists, like data stewards exist, et cetera, right? Because many business people don't even know about those names. They say, hey, it's all IT, you know. So you basically have to educate the people. And right now, a lot of business people are actually somebody who all those vendors are talking to, and people are actually getting educated from the vendors. And vendors, are preying on the folks. They're saying, hey, this is a wonderful tool. All you need to do is just to buy this tool and your data quality problems will disappear. And the businesses kind of say, oh, yeah, this is what I need. They're buying the tool, and it's a wrong tool, of course. And then IT trying to implement it, and then, you know, nothing's going to go, right? Again, the process is not there, so the maturity is not there. So that's why, again, I think the educational thing is that we have to go first. The data literacy on everything.
So I've talked a little bit about the poisoned well of everybody gets most of their information from people that are either at vendors or sponsored by vendors. And, you know, I've relatively maintained my independence, but even I, you know, have my vendors that I prefer and like to work with and things like that. And you know, there are some that have done a great job, but yes, as you're saying, a lot of it is, and we're the panacea. And that's been the way that people have learned about things and data for far too long. And it's why when you tell people that they have to develop the process relative to their own organization, which is so crucial to Data Mesh and to so many of these other things that are proving value for the companies doing them right, people get frustrated because it's like, no, I want to copy paste because the vendor has told me if they've given me an if then statement of if I buy then value, and you're telling me I have to develop an ML model. And it's not an if-then statement, and therefore, no, I don't want to do that because that's far more work. And so, yeah, it's a great it's frustrating, but it's kind of where we are right now. You know, when I ask for people for suggestions for my podcast, 80% of the suggestions were at vendors. They're just the evangelists. They're the product marketing folks. It's the like people are just not so. But also, we've talked about a whole heck of a lot of different things. Is there anything we didn't cover that you wanted to, or any way specifically you'd like to wrap up the episode?
No, I just wanted to tell people, please learn the history, learn the people who did a lot of work, and because everything new is kind of like something old that was already forgotten. No reason to invent new words and then try to get them adopted, because maybe we could look up some words that we already invented and we already adopted. So let's just do that. And also, yeah, this is actually an interesting conversation. Thank you very much.
And I'm sure there'd be a lot of people that would love to follow up with you. Is there anything, any place specifically that you'd like them following up? Any
LinkedIn.
Okay.
LinkedIn.
And any specific topic or just all quality, anything we talked about here?
Yeah. Anything, yes.
Okay, Great. Well, I'll drop your LinkedIn in the show notes so people can easily find you. But again, thank you so much for spending the time here with me today. I really enjoyed our conversation. And as well, thank you everyone out there for listening.
Thank you. Bye.
I'd again like to thank my guest today, Olga Majdanchek. You can find a link to her LinkedIn, as well as some links of the many data quality precursors and pioneers in the show notes that she had mentioned as per usual. Thank you. Hopefully that interview episode was really useful for you. Please do consider getting in touch with guests from the show, from these episodes. Most have said they'd really love people to reach out to them. And please, as well, if you've got a minute, rate and review the podcast somewhere. It really is honestly super helpful for other people looking into kind of data podcasts to kind of get this in front of them. Data Mesh Radio is again provided as a free community resource by Data Mesh Understanding. It's produced and hosted by me, Scott Herleman. In April of 2023, I left DataStax, who were wonderful in getting the Data Mesh community stuff started, so give them a shout for streaming and real-time AI needs. But I left to start my own industry analyst kind of information as a service firm. Our offerings are affordable, and you can do them on a one-off or a month-to-month basis. You know, read kind of, throw it on the credit card. Don't worry about like going through purchasing and things like that. The services include lots of practitioner roundtables, you know, one-on-one data mesh kind of planning or feedback sessions, and tailored introductions to other data mesh practitioners that are focused around your topics of interest. You know, what are you actually running into challenges with? We also have some free programs around introductions and roundtables that people can kind of check out as well. Check the show notes or just go to datameshunderstanding.com for more info or helpful resources. As always, if you have suggestions for guests or topics, please do get in touch as well. And have a wonderful rest of your day. Now let's hear that funky outro music.